Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the program. This is Cliff, your host, and I always reference the Facebook page because I'm constantly putting up so much stuff and people are posting material. We have the main Facebook Earth Ancients page, but there's also a blog post that now is close to 10,000 members on Facebook, and I don't always feel as really apropos to put smaller comments on the international page, which is now up to about 500,000 readers a week. At one point, it was 1 million, and it slowly dropped back to 500,000, which is the average weekly readership of an international audience. So I'm very, very happy about that. But I wanted to just touch base on a couple of things this week. Holly Albergus was the guest last week, and she brought a tremendous amount of content regarding this Atacama Desert civilization that she had located. And she located it not by going to the location. She located it using Google Earth and a number of other satellite resources to find this lost civilization. And very, very few people have been to this place except for a few individuals that Holly financed herself to go out and check this place out. But I just learned that the Chilean government and the Atacama Desert, by the way, is in South America. If you don't know about it, you can read about this entire program on the Facebook page of Earth Ancients. But the point I'm trying to make is the Chilean government has now become very, very aware that there's looting going on, which is what we just don't want. We don't want the place to be looted and damaged in any way, and has now assigned the military to do sweeps, to do canvassing with their troops, and now it's become very dangerous, and you have to get specific permits to go out there. And I kind of hinted about a group that I learned about a month ago that is going to be going out there in the fall, and I've been invited. I've been invited to join them to document the first excavations of some of the major structures there. And it appears that there's an amphitheater, which is very strange for a desert culture to build. So anyhow, take a look at the recent information that I put up on the Facebook page regarding the Nuevo Albergues, which is the lost civilization of the Atacama Desert in Chile. So that's something to focus on. Today we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about Mars, and I've had Mike Bearer on the program. We've discussed his book, Ancient Aliens on Mars 2. But I think I should preface that book by saying that in 1992 through 1999 and into the early 2000s, Richard Hoagland was beating a path on a number of Viking photographs he had discovered, and he was really the first one on a public stage who introduced the face on Mars. And I was a program director at the time with a couple of local conferences, but the largest conference was known as Whole Life. And we had Richard on the program in 1995 to discuss the face, and he would eventually go on to CNN and a number of major television networks to discuss what he believes was a major discovery, which was the face on Mars. Not only did he promote the face on Mars, but he promoted the Cydonia region of Mars as being artificial, as being man-made or ET-made, and wrote a book called Monuments of Mars, in which he makes a number of claims based on what he believed was artificial structures and other artificial, potential ET structures that are were taken by the Viking rover. But not only that, he began to claim that NASA was covering this entire discovery up. And it goes in and out, in and out. He became a conspiracy theorist eventually, and he and Mike Bearer wrote this book on NASA that basically claims that NASA was a society, or it was a secret group. It was called Dark Mission, and Mike Bearer talked with us a little bit about that. He felt, and so did Richard Hoagland, that they knew about these ancient artificial structures. They knew about the face on Mars, and that there is an ongoing investigation that the general public does not know about. So, that being said, what I later discovered was people like my guest today were very, very early researchers of this satellite imagery of the Cydonia region. And Hoagland and Bearer and other people who published their works were actually taking references from very serious researchers who had discovered these regions prior to Hoagland and others. So my guest today is George Haas, and George is the founder and premier investigator for the Cydonia Institute, which he established in 1991. He's a member of the Archaeological Institute of America and the Pre-Columbian Society of the University of Pennsylvania. He's also an artist, art instructor, writer, and a curator. He is the author of the Martian Codex and the Cydonia Codex. And we're going to be referencing quite a bit today the Cydonia Institute website, which has just some marvelous imagery and specific details that I've recently rediscovered. I actually found it a couple of years ago, but busy as I am, I wasn't able to continue looking at it. And I've really been reintroduced to it, and it's a fantastic website that I really urge you to take a look at. By the way, if you want to speak with us today, if you want to talk to our guests or ask a question, the number to call is 347-826-9565. And you can ask our guest today, George Haas, some questions. George, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. Just had lunch, done feeding the horses and taking care of the animals, and I'm ready for an interview.
Oh, fantastic. I'm out here in Oakland, California. Where are you located?
I'm in Loudoun County down here in Virginia.
Ah, you're in Virginia. Fantastic.
Yeah, it's cold here.
Well, listen.
Too,
so. Oh, is it cold there? Okay. You don't have the blizzard that the northern part of the eastern coast does, do you?
No, we didn't get any of that. We just got a little snow here. It's dusting, really. That's about it.
Fantastic. Well, hey, thanks for joining us today. I kind of prefaced our discussion today with Richard Hoagland, and his book, The Monuments of Mars, was really the first book that I am aware of on this face, the face on Mars. But he has some photographs. Mike Barra has photographs. When did you initially become interested in this Mars region of Cydonia?
Well, Randolfo Puzost was one of the first authors. He was a member of the Society for Planetary Study Research in the early 1980s. He actually worked with Richard Hoagland, and early on, Hoagland worked with a lot of the members of the Society for Planetary Study Research, which wasn't actually created yet, but they were all working together through emails through universities and stuff and doing this research. And the first book that I picked up was called Just the Face on Mars, Evidence for Lost Civilization by Puzost. And that's how I got interested. And then I later on found out about Richard Hoagland. And, Hoagland's book was great, really a big impact with our early research. And Richard Hoagland at the time, in the mid-1990s, he had the Enterprise Mission website, which was a little bit more friendly to the public at that time. You could go on there and join the discussion board, and Richard Hoagland would participate, and there was a lot of people interested in the face on Mars and the upcoming, NASA was going to take some newer pictures of the area. So everybody was very interested in what we were going to get from the Mars Global Surveyor camera. So a friend of mine, William Saunders, who's part of the Cydonia Institute, he is a geologist up in Calgary, Canada. And he was a participant on Richard's website, and that's how Bill and I met. We met on there doing, research on there together. And I also found out I lived in New Jersey at the time, and Richard Hoagland was basically in my backyard. He was up north in northern Jersey, and he had lived in New Jersey before he moved out to, Albuquerque. So I had contacted him early on and spoke to him on the phone many times. I was a subscriber to his, he had a Mars newsletter that went out. It was a quarterly that had some of the early stuff that he was working on. And his phone number and address were right on the back cover.
Wow.
Kind of weird. So you could just call him, So I called him a couple times and spoke to him about the stuff we were doing. And then he moved out to Albuquerque, and, we were still working on the website and stuff. And that's basically how I got interested in this.
Well, tell me, did you, because some of the imagery that you post on your website and in both of your books, the Martian Codex and the Cydonia Codex, obviously you have spent what I would think, is hundreds of hours going over surface imagery taken by a number of satellites. And I'm just curious, when did you begin to really identify these anomalies? Was it in the very beginning?
What happened was, everyone was focused on the face on Mars, and we had no thoughts at the time that there were going to be other geoglyphs. So we just figured that, listening to Hoagland always presented the face on Mars like this was the only facial structure that these so-called aliens on Mars built. And it was a message for us to see and find out all about the tetrahedral geometry in the Cydonia area. So a lot of people didn't even think about other faces or other geoglyphs on the planet. So we were just all focused on the face on Mars. And once the new images in 1998 came out from the Mars Global Surveyor, and we had higher resolution images, a lot of the public was disappointed because they all had envisioned, when they heard face on Mars, most people think of a symmetrical human face. They think it's going to look like Elvis Presley or Frank Sinatra, you know, just a nice symmetrical face. But that's not what the face on Mars is, as Hoagland showed early with the Viking images, that it was a bifurcated face. It had a human visage on one side and a feline on the other. And when we got the new images, the higher resolution pictures from the Mars Global Surveyor in 1998, it actually proved his hypothesis that this was a bifurcated face. And, you know, NASA immediately said, well, we took these pictures and it shows it's not a face. You know, their quotes at the time were, it shows that it's not a human face, which is technically, you know, it's kind of like Clinton speak, you know, what it is, you know, NASA's really saying it's not a human face because it's not a human face. It's a bifurcated mask, basically, of a human feline. So it's not a human face. So they're really not lying. But they're you know, redirecting people's attention. And most people in the public are, like I said, thinking that when you say there's a face on Mars, it's going to look like a human face. Mm-hmm. And the
Go ahead.
I'm listening. Yeah. You ask away.
Well, as an artist, did you immediately identify these as works of art, or did you look at them more as structural engineering?
My art background, being a sculptor, I saw artwork right off. You could see the shape of the face, all the facial structure, especially the eye, which was one of the most important things that was established with these NASA photographs. You know, NASA still maintains to this day, after they've taken close to 20 images of this formation, that, you know, it's just a pile of rocks. However, the more pictures they take, the higher resolution pictures, even with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, the high-rise camera, which took these really high-resolution pictures of the face on Mars, they all confirm all of the structure of the face. And the eye, you know, you can see the formation. It's an almond-shaped eye. It has an iris. There's structure to the eye. It's not just a blob. It's not just a dark shadow. I mean, there's three-dimensional structure to the eye. And in 2001, NASA went out of its way and took a high resolution with the Mars Global Surveyor camera, the highest resolution it was capable of taking. They took just a detail of the eye, which is very convincing. So again, it shows that the more pictures that NASA was taking of this, and you know, they were spending a lot of time taking different views of the face, different seasons, and it was all, you know, being confirmed that this was something that was a work of art. It was a structural formation that maintained its integrity through the different seasons, different lighting, and it was all right there.
Well, let me ask you, in the early days when you began to do this research on the Cydonia region, did you feel that NASA was just being ignorant of the location, or did you begin to feel after a few months or years of research and actually locating these images that there was something else going on in terms of their being able to verify and actually validate your discovery?
Well, Cliff, it's the same story. Science is slow. And, you know, the first pictures were in 1976, you know, the old, very poor Viking images. And we had to wait until 1998 before we got a second picture. And after the 98 image, we didn't get another image of the face on Mars until 2001. So it's just a long process. And we didn't have the Mars Reconnaissance High Resolution image until 2007. So it's, you know, they may have had access to look at these pictures, but publicly, you know, this is the timeline that we're looking at these things. I mean, it just takes forever.
I guess
it's a waiting game.
My point, though, George, right, my point is, you are identifying this face on Mars as an actual massive man-made or ET-made structure.
Artificially
created, and we now know through Barra's book that there's actual photos taken by Mars Express that show the infrastructure, the heavy interior beams and whatever that supports this face, and yet NASA and the European Space Agency have not come out and said, this is an artificial structure, and oh my God, we have to reconsider what was there.
Yeah, none of them have come out publicly and said that. But the other problem, I think I'm trying to, I guess I've taken a long time to answer your question, your original question about all the other structures we found. Well, just to give the timeline, when they took the 1998 image of the face, they took two other images of the Sidonia area. There was the three images that they took in 1998. So we only had three images to look at. And only one image had the face. So what's sparked our imaginations and the idea to look at other areas of the Sidonia area for similar type facial features, if there was any, was to look at these other strips that we had of the Sidonia area. And that's what led William Saunders and myself to finding other facial features, which we called these geoglyphs, that were in these other Sidonia area photographs. And once we started studying that, and of course NASA slowly took more pictures of the Sidonia area, we had other people like a guy that is, most people know by the Mars Revealer, Gary Lachure. He was actually going beyond Sidonia and looking at other images on different areas of the planet. And we were finding, hey, there's some interesting stuff all over this place. So that's what got us to look beyond Sidonia to the other parts of the planet, saying that, well, if they built this structure in Sidonia, you know, the odds are they probably built these all over the place. And that's what we were finding. They were everywhere.
So your team at Sidonia Institute has been surveying and studying the surface of Mars for how long?
Many years? Over 15 years.
Okay, so over 15 years. So obviously, you believe that these are artificial structures, and what in the 15 years that you and your team have been viewing this imagery, what conclusions can you make that you can tell our audience? Obviously, there are artificial structures, but is it your belief that this was a thriving civilization, or these just anomalous structures that were built randomly? What kind of conclusions can you give us after 15 years?
Well, beginning with the face on Mars, with the newer images, we were able to see that there was all this type of iconography that was embedded in the face. Originally, a lot of people thought the face on Mars looked Egyptian because it had the headdress, the flange side helmet or whatever on the sides of the face when it's mirrored. And a lot of things here were mirrored because, of course, if it's a half face, most people have difficulty seeing partial images, and you have to mirror them so they can see the full image. That we found a lot of the style, especially with the human and feline, not only was it found in Egypt, it was found throughout Mesoamerica, and we found that this tri-leaf was like a corn symbol on the top of the face on Mars, which we realized doing some research at the time that this was right out of Mesoamerica, and it was a lot of the lords would wear this tri-leaf symbol on their foreheads with these headbands, which was a symbol of corn, which goes back to the Olmec. And that's just one example. So we were finding all these things that seemed to have this correlation with Mesoamerica. So over the years, Bill and I feel comfortable in saying that all of these formations that we're finding have a direct artistic correlation with the cultures of Mesoamerica. And we think these structures were probably built after Mars was a dead planet, because if you look at the surrounding features of craters and things, these structures were built after the planet was destroyed, which Dr. Brandenburg, he has a science paper published last year dealing with isotopes on Mars. He's got a theory that Mars was nuked at one time, 2 points, I think, Sidonia and Ethiopia area. So he goes on about this whole idea that Mars may have been occupied at one time but was destroyed. And we're thinking these structures were all put there after Mars was a dead planet. And they were put there for us to find after we, had capabilities of doing flight and going orbiting around Mars and taking photographs, and we'd see these things, and they would relate to us.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. In your book, The Cydonia Codex, you basically show a pattern or links between ancient Mayan, or I want to say, you say Central American civilization, and a number of structures on the planet Mars. Now, you are not a you're a Mayan researcher, as I am, and would you say you're a Mayanist? Do you go in as deep as Michael Cole and some of the other archaeologists, Linda Shealy and those people, or are you more just dabbling in your interest in
Well,
Mayan culture?
I haven't gone to, mine's all self-taught. I've gone to the Maya Research Weekends for
Sure.
10 years at the University of Pennsylvania. I met a lot of the archaeologists, showed them a lot of this work. When Bill and I talk about Bill a lot because he was my partner when we were doing all this. We were doing all this research together. And Bill and I knew, what most people at the time, back in the 90s, knew about the Maya. Anything I knew about the Maya was probably stuff I read in National Geographic. And I had a very limited knowledge of what the Maya culture was about or what their motifs were and their style of art. We were taught that they were, stargazers and very peaceful people, and that's about all I knew. And I was standing, I mean, this is a true story. I was standing in the Barnes and Noble going through some history books, and I came upon Linda Shelley's book, The Forest of Kings. And I'm thumbing through there, and I started to see that's where I first saw the Maya mask with the tri-leaf formation. And I just about fell on the floor when I saw that because it just. And there's an image from the book that we have in our first book, and I think it's also on our one of the articles that we have on our website, which shows the comparison of the first Lord mask with the face on Mars. I mean, it's almost like twins. Have you seen that on
Wow.
the
I
website?
think I did. I think I did a while ago. I think that when the comparison started coming out, when your book came out on the Cydonian Codex, I think
So that
I was
just
looking at
blew
it.
us away when we saw that. That was like, wow, this is there's something to this, and that's what got us interested in doing the research with. We bought all of the Linda Shilley books. I started going to all of the conferences in Philadelphia and got to meet a lot of people, which was most of them didn't want anything to do with this research. I was having lunch at one of the conferences, and I was just happened to be sitting at all the professors that were there to speak about the Olmec culture, and I just happened to be at their table. And cause they're very friendly
Interesting.
people, the archaeologists. I mean, you go to the luncheon and they're all sitting around. You can go up to them, talk to them. They're very open to things. And I had some pictures that I wanted to show them of I had everything with me all the time in case I had the opportunity to get to talk to one of these scholars. And I opened up my book and I was showing him one of the pictures of Mars. And he actually took my notebook and closed it. He says that I can't look at these things. That was the end of that.
Because they were
He didn't have the time.
Close
He's
to the
too busy with his own
oh.
work to be looking at this anything else. Yeah.
That's an
And
interesting
they all chuckled
response.
at the table. They all chuckled at the table and then started finishing their lunch. That was the end of that. But I've had a lot of opportunities that this is how they reacted. So it's very difficult.
It's funny that you talk about that because when we had Mike Barrow on the show and his book Ancient Aliens on Mars 2, I asked him what he felt the time period was, and it's hard because we haven't really done. There's no way for us to do or know about any geology on the planet. We only can speculate that it was hit and destroyed, or he suffered a catastrophic event. But if you were to put some numbers on some of these discoveries, some of these ruins that have a Mayan flair to them, what would you say the time factor would be? Are we talking tens of thousands of years ago? Are we talking pre-dynastic Egyptian? Are we talking 10, 20, 30, 40? How many thousands of years? If you were to throw out a number, what would you
Right.
guess at a time frame?
Well, myself being an artist and I can only look at the art, a lot of the things we're finding is goes hand in hand with the creation mythology of the Maya, which, basically according to the Maya, their civilization only started, 3,000 years ago. However, they do reckoning of time that goes back a million years. I mean, if you look at some of their on some of the stela, they have times that are mentioned, you know, deep into the past and deep into the future. So it's hard to really get an idea about, you know, when the civilization started. We only have archaeological records here on Earth, you know, that bring the Maya civilization, you know, back, you know, at least to the most with the Olmec, you know, maybe 2,000 years. But what we're seeing on Mars, we think is older than that. And looking at the geology, you know, you'd have to agree with Mike Barr, you really can't tell unless you get on the ground and, you know, you do some type of geological studies. But what we try to do is we're looking at the motifs that we're seeing in the iconography and this connection with the Maya culture. And I've also, on my own, I've had this whole, my third book that hopefully will be coming out late in this year, which deals with a whole set of avian geoglyphs in the Sedona area. I've logged a dozen avian formations all in a cluster together.
And avian being birds.
Birds. All of these birds are they're recognizable birds. There's a roadrunner, there's a parrot, there's a hawk, there's a pelican, there's a couple other birds, and there's a woodpecker. Now, these are all recognizable birds that all are birds that are contemporary. We're not seeing birds from like the dinosaur-type birds, especially in this area. So whoever built these had an intimate knowledge of what our birds on our planet look like, and these are all birds that are contemporary. So then you'd have to say, well, how far back does, you know, the hawk and the eagle and the roadrunner, how far back does that species go for them to be recorded on Mars? You know what I'm saying? And
right,
it really can't be that long. I mean, the first roadrunner or woodpecker or pelican, I mean, what do they go back, 50,000 years? I don't know.
Okay. But I mean,
so it would be a lot more. These things were constructed a lot more recent than people would think.
Well, what would you say?
These aren't millions
of
years old.
Right. I mean, Barra feels, and some other people feel that some of the ruins on the face of Mars are, you know, 50,000 years ago, and they, some of them have similarities to some of the pre-dynastic Egyptian structures that are on Earth,
right,
and that a proto-Egyptian culture was sophisticated enough to travel back and forth from Mars and may have originated from Mars. Mars had a catastrophic event, and then those
right.
people had to come to Earth. So there's various theories, but
looking at around the same timeline, about 50,000 years, we're thinking.
Okay, good. What this brings up to me, though, is fascinating. And I've spoken to Mayan elders and studied the Mayan culture and continue to be fascinated with it to the point where I spent my summers for almost 5-6 years. Each summer I'd go out and spend a couple of weeks in Yucatan because I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. And to my mind, the historical records of the Maya are completely off the chart, and they're wrong. And they're wrong for a number of reasons. But I think what I want to talk to you about is two things. Number one, these features, these anomalous, what I'm going to call megaliths, because they're so big, on the surface of the planet, were made for one reason. You can't see them standing on the ground. They're just too big. They're like hills and mountains. At the scale
right.
we're talking about, they were made to be seen from space.
Exactly.
So this is a culture who built these, who had extremely sophisticated sciences. What's your say? What do you feel about that? I mean, to my mind, there's no other question. There's no other.
Yeah. Well,
there's no other answer.
This whole idea of building geoglyphs. I mean, it's a human tradition. We look around the world, especially. I mean, right here in the United States. We have the flyover country. You got when the settlers first came here, all of this was covered with all types of geoglyphs, these earthen mounds that were shaped like birds and bears and different
right.
types of animals, and there was geometric shapes. They were all over the place, and a lot of them were destroyed with the onslaught of you know, urban renewal and people building cities and things. So you had all that going on here. Down in Peru, you have the Nazca Line, and even some of the surrounding cities like Cusco, that was originally built in the shape of a crouching tiger or a puma. Some of the other towns were shaped like llamas and things. So viewed from the air, they look like birds. There's one area that has this running bird. The whole town is shaped like a little running bird and different animals. And even Machu Picchu, there was some independent archaeologists down in Peru that put out a book a couple years ago about the Machu Picchu. And they say that the whole, if you look at the structure from the air, it looks like a large condor with a big wing that goes up, and that they show all the structures get the form to the body. So this whole idea of creating cities and landmarks and mounds that look like, you know, pictures from the sky, that's what we're seeing on Mars also.
So this is a prehistoric civilization on Earth, obviously, that built these geoglyphs to be seen only from the air. And this is what drives me nuts. And of course, the bottom line for our scientists is that, well, where is the proof that there were flying machines? Where is the proof that there was a technology that enabled prehistoric man to fly high into the atmosphere of Earth or Mars and into the space? And it does.
Or they may have been communicating to someone else that could fly. You know, a lot of scientists and archaeologists will say, well, the American Indians built these mounds to communicate with the gods above, the spirits. Same thing with the Peruvian lines. There's some researchers that think that these were ceremonial lines that they would walk around in the shape of the animals, you know, for spiritual things. And, of course, they made them large, and that could be that the gods could see them. You know, that's an explanation, but, you know, it seems like you could do a lot of other things to get the attention of the gods besides building these huge, you know.
Well, I mean, and then we get to Mars, where we have these deliberate, extremely large, some of them in the case of the face on Mars is 1 mile by a mile and a half across,
right,
or a mile across, which are works of tremendous engineering. But not only that, the subtlety of the design on not only the face on Mars, but the pyramids, some of the smaller structures, it's just amazing. And when we realize, now we realize that these are actual buildings and structures that had inner rooms and galleries and amphitheaters, probably, we don't know, but we're guessing based on the structure, the integrity of these buildings that we found, you have a very sophisticated civilization that built these. And when I look at your work, I'm just floored. At these geoglyphs that are massive, that are just massive, and to say that they were done randomly, it doesn't make any sense to me.
And they're so big.
How do you
explain
this?
Well, the point that they're so big, you know, the detractors use that against us, because even the eye on the face on Mars is so huge and massive. If you take the high-resolution camera and you zoom in on it, and, you know, they come right in on the left side of the eye there, and they're looking, and it's like, look, this is just the ground. There's nothing here. It's like, yeah, but if you zoom in on the Mona Lisa on the lips, I mean, it's just going to look like a bunch of swirly paint swirls. You're going to say, well, that's not lips. You know what I mean? You have to have the proper viewing perspective. And these things are so complicated and so precise in their structure that when they're viewed at the precise viewing distance, you know, above the planet, then everything comes into focus and boom, there it is.
Do you think Malin's group at NASA and some of the other teams at Earth Express are in the know about these structures, or are they just completely in denial?
Well, I think from all of the examples that I've seen, they have to know that there's artificial structures on the surface. You'd have to be blind not to see some of these things, especially with the face. But, you know, I guess it's all politics and the political roads they're going down, they have to deny all this or not even talk about it. And, you know, the media is really not very interested in this stuff either.
Which is fascinating because...
You know, the media, they like little sound bites. You know, everything has to be quick to understand. I mean, could you imagine talking about the face on Mars when you have to tell them that it's a two-faced structure, and then, first of all, 99% of them never even heard of a two-faced mass that was created by the Mayan. Then you have to talk to them and educate them about the Mayan. And then, you know, it just gets so convoluted and so complex that it's not an easy sell for the media. You know, there's too much going on. And then, of course, the first thing they ask is, you know, who put it there? Why is it there? Like a child.
Yeah, it's like it's too much. It's just too much to express. But, you know, in the Cydonia Codex, that book relates to similarities with Central American, Mesoamerican cultures. But then you came out with another book called the Martian Codex. What is that focused on? What's the Martian Codex? What's the focus?
That was our... The Martian Codex was our second book. And starting with the first one, we called it the Maya or the Cydonia Codex because we were like making a play on the Maya codexes, you know, with all this language and this the hieroglyphics that the Maya created. And we were looking at the face on Mars and its surrounding images that these were... this was a language that we were looking at. So in the second book, we retitled the Martian Codex because we're thinking that it's the Martian Codex was first, and that's where the Maya Codex came from because they were basically educated by whoever built this. They kind of like bestowed all of this knowledge onto the Maya, and they were just mimicking all of this, taking this history and everything. So it was kind of the other way around.
You know, you have gone at these discoveries very scientifically and have written a number of papers. We're going to talk about the most current paper in a bit, the Nefertiti face. But when you find, like, you found all these birds and you found a number of portraits, what do you think, can you date them, or not date them, but can you show a chronological order based on what you find? In other words, do some look newer than others? Like maybe
some of them look pretty pristine. Even some of the things over in the Cydonia area. So we're not sure if they were newer or they just didn't get as much erosion. And you know, you hear about these little dust storms on Mars, but you know, I'm not a scientist, but you know, Mars doesn't have a lot of gravity like we have here on Earth. So when we have these huge, you know, the pressure and everything with these big tornadoes that come through and rip up houses, I don't really know how powerful the little dust devils are on Mars to do anything. They might push some of the dust around on the surface, but are they really capable enough? Are they powerful enough to do erosion on a structure? You know what I'm saying? So I don't know what is causing the erosion. If the erosion is just part of the camouflage that the builders incorporated into these structures. The Maya have a story about the creation mythology where the lords of creation, they had the book of creation that was hidden from the seeker and the followers that couldn't be seen. It was hidden. And so Bill and I, we had the thoughts that maybe Mars was this hidden, the Popol Vuh, the lost book, that this whole planet Mars is the Popol Vuh from the Maya. It has all of the history and the pictographic history of man etched and created on this planet. And it's hidden. So when you first look at the pictures, you may not see that there's an antelope over there or whatever creature or the face on Mars. It may just look like, you know, it's part of the mountains. But then when you look at it in a different way, you say, oh, wow, that looks like a face there. Oh, and the other side looks like a feline. And then you build on that and you start seeing things that come to light on other parts of the planet. So this whole idea of things being hidden in plain sight is all right out of the Mesoamerican idea.
In your in the Cydonia Codex, you use this mirroring quite a bit. And I wanted to get clarification about that, and I want you to talk to our audience about that, because you actually will mirror one side of a structure, and it will actually transform it. But thing that I need to get understand from that type of referencing or imaging is that that wasn't in the intention of the artist engineer. It was is something else. Why don't you explain to us what the mirroring does?
Well, again, with all of this is directly related to Mesoamerican culture. And this whole idea with mirroring, Richard Hoagland kind of stumbled on this when he looked at the first Viking images of the face on Mars. And he noticed that the feline sign was dark, you know, because it was the original image that got most of the attention in the early 70s, or the mid-70s, was the famous face on Mars with the dark side, and you see the human visage on the one side. And he just mirrored it. He just put a mirror and see what it would look like if it was symmetrical. And then he mirrored the other side and saw that it looked like a feline. That's when he said, oh, this is the embodiment of the human and feline, and kind of related it to the Sphinx in mm-hmm. Egypt. So this whole idea of mirroring was in our heads when we got the newer images of the face on Mars, and we again mirrored the human and feline side, and they said, oh yeah, it still looks like there's a human face here, and the other side looks like even more like a lion. And then when they took the higher resolution pictures, everything seemed to be, you know, it all would stand up. You still would see this human and feline visage on the planet in this sculpted formation. And again, doing the research with Linda Shelley, you know, finding that book, and we realized that the Maya used mirrors in their ceremonies. They also had hieroglyphs that would have a mirror that would be a half a mirror, and they produce a lot of masks and sculptures that were just half of an image. And archaeologists were very perplexed for a long time about why the Maya were doing these half images. And one researcher a couple years ago decided that the reason they were doing this was when a ruler of a city or a town or one of the lords passed away, they would take some of his prized possessions, his little sculptures and his medallions and things, and they would cut them in half. And they'd leave half in the upper world, and the other half of the mask or figure would go into the tomb with the dead deceased lord, and he'd be buried in the underworld. So half of it would be in the underworld, and the other half would be in the upper world. And the Maya were all, this very instrumental part of their mythology is, you know, the upper world and the gods of the underworld. So this whole idea of things cut in half falls in direct line with this whole idea of the Maya. And we were finding a lot of half and two-faced images in the Sidonia area. That's why we were in the book, especially the famous half image of it looks like a Viking face. It's just a half image.
Right.
And so we got a lot of criticism early on for, you know, mirroring. People were saying, well, you could mirror anything, wood grain, and you're going to see a face. But these things, you could see them without mirroring them. You could see the half portrait, you know, on the surface of the planet. But we just mirrored them to make it more accessible for people to see. But our intention wasn't that these things are meant to be mirrored. It's just that they're using half of an image, because this goes right along with the whole idea of the Maya religion about, you know, things being cut in half and put in the upper and lower worlds. American Indians made half masks. They had the same idea, this whole, the half spirit, you know, in the upper and lower world.
Right.
So
right.
It's a traditional thing, and we're seeing the same idea on Mars. In 2001, down in southern, in South America, down at the peninsula down there, there was a culture down there, and they were just digging up and doing an archaeological survey down there. And as they were flying supplies in, one of the guys looked out the window, just like they discovered in the early 1900s, the Peruvian land drawings. They're down there in South America flying in supplies to do this archaeological dig, and they look out the window, and there's this huge half of a geoglyph, a half face.
Mm.
So it's just the same type of half face images that we're finding on Mars. Now, the geologist or archaeologist that found that, you know, they didn't run out and mirror it. They said, well, this is a half mask here etched in on the surface of the desert. But we're finding these on Mars, and the reason we are mirroring them just to make it easier for people to see.
Hmm. Okay, so that was more of a help with identifying what these images are.
Right.
We've discussed, and I haven't heard a lot about from you as a sculptor, the engineering feats to make these monstrous megalithic structures, but is there anything that you've found that correlates any of these structures to anything that you've found in Central America? In other words, have you discovered any geoglyphs in Central America that are kind of similar to anything on the surface of Mars?
No, there are, besides that one half a glyph down in South America, in Mesoamerica, the Maya, the Aztec, the Olmec, none of them produced any facial features of large geoglyphs that, you know, look up to the sky. There's nothing like that at all. Their large constructions are basically just pyramids, which are, you know, they were just trying to mimic the shape of a mountain, the whole idea of a pyramid. And, no, we have found nothing comparable in Mesoamerica or anywhere else in the world that where someone has produced a large geoglyph of this size.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the theory that I have is that there was a proto-Maya or early civilization that morphed into the Maya following
the Olmec. The Olmec were the early. The Olmec were the early. That was the mother culture.
Well, but do we know? I mean, there's new proof now by a number of discoveries that the Maya were contemporaries to the Olmec. I think Dr. Jensen and
towards the decline of the Olmec culture, the Maya were contemporaries, but all of the mm-hmm. writing system, all of the mythology was all taken from the Olmec. It's kind of like the old adage where you have the Greeks, you know, the Romans took everything from the Greeks,
right.
Basically. It's the same right. thing happened with the Olmec. So everything started with the Olmec. And one of the old Maya cities, which goes back to the Olmec time, is called Naranjo. We mentioned Naranjo in our first book. Their patron god was the Zip Monster down in Mesoamerica in the town called Naranjo. And Naranjo means orange. You know, the planet Mars is kind of like an orangish color. And their patron god was the Zip Monster, which is the planet Mars. So this whole connection to Mars goes right back to this ancient, one of the first cities constructed in Mesoamerica from the Olmec to the Maya, called Naranjo. Their patron god was the Zip Monster, which is Mars. And in their mythology, they talk about what archaeologists call, this is not me, they call it the Star Wars, which is kind of play on the, you know, George Lucas Star Wars. And what their texts talk about on their monuments and their stela is that there was this war between an unknown group on Earth and Mars. And it goes into detail about all this struggle and this war going on, which is kind of interesting when you consider that we're finding all of this Mesoamerican-type imagery on Mars, and you know, Dr. Brandenburg is talking about this war going on Mars at one time that you know, devastated the entire planet.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't take much of you know, an intellect to follow the dots here.
Okay, let's see. I think we have a question here. Hold on a second. Do you have a question for our guest? Hello.
Yes, I do. Hello?
Can you tell us your name and where you're calling from? First name, please.
My name is David, and I'm calling from Chicago.
Okay. What can you? What would you like to ask our guest, David?
I wanted to ask if he thinks that these structures were built by humans who traveled to Mars, or if they were built by, you know, some type of extraterrestrial that traveled to both Mars as well as Earth.
Hi, David. That's a good question. Bill and I, we've knocked around this idea for a long time about, you know, who built them. We kind of go along the lines of the interpretation of the ancient Sumerian text by Zachariah Sitchin. We think this has a lot to do with the ancient Anunnaki. That occupied, according to the ancient Sumerian text, they had a way station on Mars, and that's where the Igi maintained a base, and that possibly, if you follow the stories with Enki and Marduk, that the two were had these major wars that may have transcended up to Mars. And after all of this was done, maybe, possibly, Marduk, in a blasphemy type of act against his father, put up all these structures which revealed the sacred history of man on the surface of Mars, which he was not attributed to have because he wasn't the firstborn son. If you look into some of these stories from the which Zachariah Sitchin has in his books, it's very interesting that we're finding all this stuff on Mars that may have this direct connection with that culture.
Okay, so yeah, I've read some of his books, and they're very interesting. So I'm definitely gonna look into that more. Are there any other civilizations or texts that have referenced, you know, themselves or their ancient, forefathers being on Mars or traveling to Mars?
I guess in India there's stories. If you look into some of those so-called mythological stories, what we're intrigued by with the Anunnaki stories, because the supposedly Ningestada, Marduk's brother, he had gone down to South America and taken the black-headed people, which were the Olmec, which started the Maya civilization, which had all this history. So if all this seems to just tie together perfectly from what we've found on Mars, where you have an ancient civilization that comes to Earth and finds the available man, probably Cro-Magnon or Neanderthal, whoever they used, and they created us. And once we evolved, I guess because the big mistake that the Anunnaki made was they used a real aggressive creature that they found here, the Cro-Magnon or Neanderthal, whoever, I guess Sitchin talks about that they used as a guinea pig to use their DNA and create the human race, that although the Anunnaki were kind of like a stoic race, kind of like Spock on Star Trek, lacked a lot of emotion and they're just very, cerebral creatures, that they created us who were part Anunnaki and part, beast of the wild. And we were uncontrollable. I mean, we can't get along with anybody here. I mean, look what's going on in the world. So I guess they got the heck out, they got the heck out of Dodge, and here we are. And now we're finding our origins, etched all over the planet Mars.
Thanks for your question, David. In the few minutes we have left, George, I want you to discuss this newest paper that you're publishing, the Nefertari paper, and what's the significance of it? And tell us a little bit about how you wrote it and who you presented it to, because it's like a scientific paper, very, very detailed.
Yeah, it's an actual science paper. Well, this all started with a member of the Society for Planetary Study Research. His name is John Lavastor, L-A-V-A-S-S. He found this image in the NASA archives back in 2001. And so he's been working with this image for a while, and it's been all over the Internet. And people at the time, because it kind of looked Egyptian, it got the moniker of the Nefertiti face. But it basically looks like this young portrait of a woman with a large cylindrical headdress. And so a lot of us that do this research, we've known about this for a while, this image, and it's very intriguing. But we only have two images. We have a first image that was taken, I think, in 2000. It's like a partial image. You don't have the whole headdress. And then the best image is a Mars Global Surveyor image that was taken in 2001, which shows the whole head, the torso, or not the torso, from the shoulders up through the cylindrical headdress. And so we didn't get any new images until the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter high-rise CTX camera took a lot more pictures in around 2009, 2010. And the thing, if you're trying to put a paper together to get published in any type of science journal, especially because of the topic here, you're dealing with possibility of artificial structures on the surface of Mars, you got to have more than one image for them to even look at these papers. So we now have four images from NASA that we used to put this paper together, two of the Mars Global Surveyor images and two images from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. So I notified JP about a year and a half ago. Bill and I have been working on this for a while. So altogether, the paper from the beginning to having it published took about 3 years. So it's a long process. And we originally got the paper, we submitted it to a conference that took place in Albuquerque, New Mexico last year. It was called the Space Technology and Applications International Forum, and it was headed by Dr. Brandenburg, who's on the board, and he suggested that we submit the paper, and it was accepted last April, and it was presented by one of the paper's authors, Dr. Horace Crater, who's a physicist at the University of Tennessee, and so he presented the paper for us, and it was well received, and after that, we were ready to submit it to the Journal of Space Exploration, which is a publication out of India. And so we submitted that last summer and was accepted, I think, in October, November, and now published in their winter issue, which just came out.
Okay.
So we're pretty excited about that.
Tell us what that means when it's presented, and what was the reaction to this information by a scientific board?
Well, at the conference, there's a whole group of scientists that belong to this this committee down there, which Dr. Brandenburg just happens to be on the board. And they discuss all kinds of things. They have all types of scientific papers that are presented. And nothing's published there. It's just for scientists to come and present new work. I think it was presented as a PowerPoint presentation. And from what Dr. Horace tells us, it was very well received. He presented a couple other papers that were put together for some of the other members. So it was a very important event for the group down there.
As the founder and president of the Cydonia Institute, what is your hope for in the next few years in terms of additional discoveries and what you've already discovered on the surface of Mars? What would you like to see happen?
Well, for myself? Or for
sure.
The whole? Well, I'm just finished up with my third book, which deals with all of these bird formations in Cydonia, which I'm trying to get finished and sent out to my publisher for, you know, to hopefully have published this year. Bill and I and some of the members of the Society for Planetary Study Research are working on another paper dealing with the crown face, which is another portrait, which was this image is something that was discovered by Greg Orme, who's another member of the Society for Planetary Study Research. And so we're all working on that. Hopefully we'll get that submitted in April to this the Staff 2 conference, the Space Technology and Applications International Forum in April. This is a yearly event that they do. So we're going to try to get the paper presented there first, and if it's received well and with suggestions about anything to add to the paper, submit that to the some journals and see what happens. So we're really confident that this research is moving along pretty strong at a strong pace, and one of the main goals here is just to get this stuff out to the public and get public's reaction, you know, so they can have opportunity to download the papers, read them. I mean, we have a website full of stuff. And, you know, if people go through all the stuff that we've done, I mean, we've got two science papers, the first one dealing with a parrot formation on Mars, and this current paper with the profile image, popularly known as the Nefertiti face. If they look at all this stuff and they find only one image that they think is artificial, that's a success for us.
Interesting. I was kind of hoping that you would say something like, well, we really want to hear from JPL or NASA that, yes, there is artificial structures on Mars. But maybe that's not going to happen in our lifetime.
Well,
maybe
I think
there's going to have to be.
If we hear that from more and more scientists, like with our first paper that we put out, the parrot with the parrot formation, we had three veterinarians, independent veterinarians, that submitted to the paper that are on the list of authors, that they believe that that's an artificial structure on the surface of Mars. So it's just, you know, one step at a time. And the Society for Planetary SETI Research is a growing organization. They get a lot of new members. And a lot of these researchers here all believe that there's a lot of stuff on Mars that is artificial. Not only these geoglyphic formations, but there's some other structural things. There's pyramids and things like that. So it's a growing community. And I think I'd love for, JPL or NASA employee to come out and say that, you know, these things are artificial, or any of them are. But I don't think they'd ever do that publicly. But what we're trying to do is get the growth in the scientific community, which once you get more and more ammunition on that side of the aisle, then possibly NASA will then take a second look or go publicly with what they know.
Fantastic.
That's how I see it. Anyway.
We can learn. That's great. So we can learn about more about your work at the CydoniaInstitute.com. What's the website for Cydonia Institute?
If they just type in Cydonia Institute, it'll come up. We're all over the place. Just type in George Haas, Mars, and you'll have all kinds of things.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I really appreciate you being on the program today. Continued great success. I'm going to start publishing and posting more of your work on the Facebook page, because I find this fascinating. I think of all the Mars researchers, you not only are the one of the older researchers,
what
but
do you
your
mean by
document.
That?
You're one of the you tend to document a lot more material than say Mike Barra or Hoagland. Hoagland hasn't written a book in a number of years, so really appreciate your research. Now, what do you other than this third book? Are you going to be? Have you been on television yet on any of the programs like Ancient Aliens or any of those programs?
Well, I was invited on Ancient Aliens last year when they were doing the last program they did on Mars. They did the Mars program, which really featured, I think a quarter of the program had Dr. Brandenburg on it about his discovery of his theory about the war and things going on Mars. They filmed me for about an hour. I was talking about the parrot formation and some of the other things that we were working on. And I guess it all hit the cutting room floor. After I saw the program they put out about Mars, I could see that nothing I was talking about would really go with the program. Because each program they put out has like a theme. And they really weren't talking about any type of pictographic formations on Mars. It was mostly about this catastrophe that happened there. And of course they mentioned the face on Mars and things like that. But my big debut is on the cutting room floor, I guess. They never called me back.
Oh, boy. Well...
Well, I know they're very interested in the profile face or the Nefertiti face, and they did mention they wanted to talk to us about that and also have J.P. Levasseur. They wanted to speak to him, but we haven't gotten any calls. But, they're always doing new programs, and we'll see what happens. But as for being on TV, that was my only shot. I haven't really been on any programs. If anybody's out there, I'm here.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely have you on the program again as this third book comes out. When does it due? It's due what, this year?
I'm hoping. Well, it hasn't been approved through the publisher yet. I still have about 70 drawings to do because I do all the illustrations. If you notice the two books, all the drawings and things I do in there of all of the artifacts, because a lot of these museums and stuff, it's really costly to get them to let you use a picture of a Mesoamerican vessel. They want $300 just to use one image.
Oh,
and it does add up.
Yeah.
Well, and publishers don't want to pay for that. So because I can draw and do some illustrations and things, I've been spending my time doing that. And the current book has a lot of pictures and examples and things that I've been doing drawings of. So I have a lot of work ahead of me.
Fantastic. George, thank you for joining me, and we'll be looking on the lookout for this new book, and I'll definitely have you on the program again. It's been a pleasure.
All right, Cliff. Well, maybe we'll have the Crown Face Science paper done before the book, and I'll talk to you about that.
definitely have you on again. Thanks. So that's today's program. Thanks very much, and have a great week, and look for us next week when we have our next guest.